Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his 2007 memoir, A Long Way Gone, Ishmael Bea wrote about narrowly escaping a massacre in his village in Sierra Leone and his subsequent descent into depravity as a child soldier. The characters in his new novel, Radiance of Tomorrow, are making another journey back home to their scorched earth and discarded bones left behind by a long and brutal civil war. Those finding their way to the village of Imperi carry with them memories of horror, sometimes visible in amputated limbs, sometimes buried deep and silently in through them. The novel asks what happens when those whose lives have been scarred, both as victims and perpetrators, try to create a future. And Ishmael Bea is here in Concord to read at Gibson's Books. We're so grateful he could stop and speak with us beforehand. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mama Kadi, she is this character who's limping back to the village of Imperi at the beginning of the book. The scene of a massacre some 7 years before that she managed to escape. Why did she return to a place of such horror?
Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask is in this book is that what is the idea of home? Regardless of what had happened, people had this nostalgia to return to where their home had been. And so they're coming hoping that they would go back to their lives. And if not, to recreate something sort of equal to what their lives had been. So Mama Kadi is actually returning. She's asking herself those very same questions, you know, because all through her journey, running from the war, becoming internal refugee in her country, she's not satisfied wherever she is.
She said she couldn't be happy anywhere else.
Exactly. She couldn't be happy anywhere else because really home is only where her spirit would rest. So she decided to make the journey, and so all the people in the narrative who decide to go back home to find a place where their spirit can rest, even though this is also where their spirit had been shattered to some extent.
And when she gets there, she comes upon an old friend, Pa Moiwa?
Yes.
Pa Moiwa, who's afraid to look at her. Why?
Well, one of the things I wanted to discuss in this novel is that often when wars end, I don't think people really look at the difficulties of trying to return and what that means. Because the ways things have been done have changed. There's a new kind of hesitancy. And one of those is that when you hear somebody who you've heard, you know from before, you didn't want to turn around and look at them because during the war people were amputated, whether it could be hands, limbs, mouths, ears, and things like that. So when you look at somebody, you began to literally do a roll call on their body parts to see, is this there, is this there, are you functioning, you know. So when they had this encounter, he was looking to see. Because if somebody was close to you, whatever had happened to them, you're going to take on some of that burden yourself.
So he's afraid he's going to see this wreckage. And many of all of the characters carry a vestige of the war with them. There's a little bit of suspiciousness of each other. One of the characters you write about says they have adopted the reflex of not believing in kindness. Is this a legacy?
Yes, this is definitely something that comes out of the war because before the war, Sierra Leone was a very kind place. You walk down a path 6-7 miles, people would take care of you, they would feed you, nothing. During the war, kindness itself could cause you a lot of harm. So when you hadn't seen anybody during the war for a week or two and you saw them, you didn't know what to say to them because you didn't know whether they were a spy for one group or the other, and it could cost you your life. So after the war ended, people had to relearn how to change those reflexes. Mm. Even encountering a young boy on a path, a young man with a machete on a path, had become there's another connotation now added to it. Whereas before, you did not flinch when you encountered him. You just say, hey, hello, so where are you going to the farm, you know? Also, in addition to how you greeted people, people did not greet each other elaborately any longer because they feared asking those questions about how are you, how is your son, your grandson. Nobody knew who you had lost.
Well, you returned. You went back to your home, and now you're a UNICEF ambassador, an advocate for children affected by war. But there are characters in the novel who are reluctant to tell their children who were not alive or not aware of what happened during the war. How do you spread this awareness? How do you let people know what happened without reawakening the trauma?
Well, that is a difficult question, and also is what is posed in this narrative, is that for some people, their method of recovering, their way of recovering is not to speak about the past. And sometimes they just don't know how to explain to the younger generation really what had happened.
They're the children of Bokhari, I think is his name. They ask, why do Sila and his sons have no hands? What does he tell them?
The point that I was trying to make is that also in post-war context, what happens is that there are people who are born at the very end of the war, who do not have any recollection of what has happened. And now it becomes the task of the community and their parents to decide whether they want to tell them.
So some of those stories are kind of concealed from children, but we also get this sense of the storytelling tradition from Makadi and the elders. And beautiful examples of the Mende language. You are Mende?
I am Mende, yes.
So give us some examples of how this language, I mean, it must be so interesting for you to kind of be translating it into continental English or Pidgin at the same time.
Yes, well, for me, the storytelling in the book is also a way to begin to repair some of the broken bonds, you know. And I grew up in a a context where we think of story as medicine.
Do they actually call it that? They call it medicine?
Yes, story is medicine. When I was a kid, my grandmother would tell me stories are medicine, and each evening would tell you one to prepare you, to kind of give you the antidotes that you need. And later on in your life, you will know why some of these stories would make sense to you. And when I was a boy, I thought, well, can you just tell me why it means to me? And my grandmother would say, no. But going back to your earlier question with the language, you know, when I'm writing, you know, I speak some languages in Sierra Leone, in particular Mende, which is my mother tongue. I'm always thinking in that language because all of the characters are set in Sierra Leone, in that landscape. And I, as a writer, I believe that language has to fit landscape. So I think of the story in Mende, and then I try to find the English equivalent of them. So I'm doing translations as I'm writing as well. And some translations are direct, and they're beautiful, and some I have to work for in terms of finding the mannerisms of people or finding certain images that will have people feel a certain way that I want them to feel.
Well, because the sky is a character, the ground is
exactly
a character, the trees are characters.
Yes, because, you know, we believe in the natural world has a life of its own. So when I write, you see that the natural world, the trees, the sky, the breeze itself, the path, they are not just bystanders or onlookers. They are part. They are characters in the narrative, you know. And you know, for example, when this "The Radiance of Tomorrow" the novel opens, Mama Kadi is walking on the path, and I talk about how the warmth of the bare feet will give life to the road. And if you've been in a small village, you see that when people walk on a path, it's kind of the grass doesn't grow there. It grows everywhere else closer, but it won't grow there, you know. And in a way, it's not me trying to be flowery. This is how people speak.
We're speaking with Ishmael Bea. His new novel is called Radiance of Tomorrow, and he's with us to talk about going back to a village in Sierra Leone and what the meaning of home is for people who have suffered tremendously during this war. Millions of people displaced, 50 to 70,000 people killed. And there are characters like the Colonel, a hardened face, young, but the face that's sort of embittered by life, and he returns with a couple of men, young boys who are obedient to him. So we guess that he's a former child soldier, the experience that you had. And he becomes a kind of sentry for this village, but still has this hair trigger. And I'm wondering about your experience, you know, after the experience that you had of, you know, being drugged out and carrying an AK-47 or being seized upon people. Do you have this hair trigger? How did you get rid of it?
Well, for Colonel in this narrative, it's not necessarily hair triggered. I was trying to, Colonel was a very difficult character to write because of trying to walk a fine line between showing a character that because of their experiences of being in the war has learned that you must never allow anybody to trample on your dignity or on your humanity. Mm. And so he's using techniques he's learned from something that's not so good to protect the dignity of his community and himself. So I had to walk that fine line by saying that without endorsing violence as an alternative to maintaining one's dignity. Mm-hmm. So that was really what that is. And that strength for me, and the point I'm trying to make here is not necessarily about a hair trigger, which I have in me as well, is that when you come out of such an experience, oftentimes people think that everything you've learned was negative or bad, so you must be cleansed of it. But rather, I really think about it the other way, that you can refocus some of the things that you learn in a war, because what the fact that you survived required a remarkable intelligence and also a strength in your character in some way. So he had a sense of leadership. For example, he's looking after all these young people who have become sort of family and his responsibility. And he sees injustice in ways that some people may brush it off, but he knows when you let go one small injustice, it just becomes another and another. And so he has this kind of character that is sort of, can do what he wants and would not allow anybody to dictate how he lives his life.
That's a very optimistic view, Ishmael, that that not everything you learn in a war is bad. We often don't think about that. You know, we think of the emotional burden rather than the lessons.
Yes. I mean, of course, there is a difficulty and emotional burden, but there are things that can be refocused. You know, for example, you know, during the war for me, you know, being a soldier, any soldier, and child soldier also, is that you learn discipline. You can sit somewhere and they tell you, guard this post, and you do it with your life. Now, if you use that same discipline to study, which is what I did when I was in school, I would sit somewhere and say, I wouldn't leave until I read this book. Even if my legs are falling asleep, I know how to do that. I can sit there. I had insomnia when I came out of the war, and most people say, you should see a doctor. You know, when I was in university, I had my insomnia was very strong. I could sleep 2 hours a night if I could, you know. And everybody was thought I was bad. And I thought to myself, well, what young person would not want to have insomnia when you're in university, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was up. I did all my work. I did my readings. I went to a party. I came back. I did more reading, you know. So I refocused and used some things to my advantage. You know, if I went in a given day and I only had, you know, a small amount of food to eat and some water, it did not throw off my day because I've gone longer being hungry. Mm. So some of these things are strengths, but oftentimes we just look at them as burdens and they become only that.
The people who return and make their way to Imperi kind of create a community, a bustling community. But life creeps back in. We have a corrupt principal getting paid for more teachers than are actually on the books. The government declares the kids have to wear uniforms to school, which discounts some of them. They can't afford them. And the government also sells out a 99-year lease to this mining company. It's almost like another invasion. Tell me about that literary device of this mining company always grinding through.
What I was going to look at is that, okay, people return and they begin to put their lives back together, but they have to find opportunity in order to take care of themselves and their families. And then, of course, here comes a mining company. And the point I was trying to look at also was that, you know, in post-war settings, often most companies would not go to invest in countries because they're worried about security reasons. So the ones that you have coming are the ones who don't have the right human right records. Mm-hmm. So they're coming knowing that they're going to get what they want because they're the only people there. And, of course, they don't care. They want to extract at the expense of other people's lives. So they will start doing that. Mm-hmm. And even the community is split on that because they see it as opportunity.
Right. But the kids drop out of school and they go to work for the mining company.
And they're thinking, well, should this opportunity destroy our traditions and our lives in the pursuit of that? So you have this push and pull that's there. And lastly, the point that's really important, this new invasion is even worse than the war because in the sense that during the war, when you ran away from home, you knew you always come back to that place. But the way this mining company is going about extracting the natural resources, they're destroying the physicality of that land itself. So, and home means different things to people. So you will never be able to come back to where your ancestors are buried because you'll be flooded and other things would happen to it. You know, so there is a different kind of war they have to face in a way.
Mm. And some of them do flee.
Yes.
Trying a couple other towns, but eventually ending up in Freetown, the capital. Mm. It feels like a really chaotic place. Do you feel hopeful about that?
Yes, it is a chaotic place. I feel hopeful about it. I think what I'm trying to say is to really show the different parts of the country and what's happening in post-war. As a country itself, it's learning to find its identity again, you know. And so that you see that being shown in the characters, what they embrace now, what they look for in people, what they look for to determine somebody's good character has changed, you know. And all the young people, the population has changed. So most people are now in the capital city looking for opportunities. But there are too many of them to find the opportunity. For me, I think it's a hopeful ending because at the end of it, they are still there and they hope that tomorrow would be different, right?
There's a radiance of tomorrow.
Exactly, because tomorrow hasn't arrived yet, so the possibilities are there. Because in the context that I come from, it's not a la-la-la ending and go prancing in the sunlight for most people. But the end of the day, you know, if you've been to a place like Sierra Leone in Freetown, people will struggle all throughout the day. But in the evening, you would not know who is a struggling man and who is a rich person. Everybody will come out and celebrate life like there's no tomorrow. And they will start all over again. And that's the strength, you know.
Well, Ishmael Beya, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ishmael Beya, putting some meat and muscle on the skeleton of Sierra Leone. His new novel is called Radiance of Tomorrow. He is also author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, A Long Way Home. It's a book about his life as a child soldier fighting in Sierra Leone's civil war. You'll find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land.
There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Unlike the characters in Ishmael Beya's book, my first visit to a village in Sierra Leone was not a return, but a kind of awakening and an introduction to lives and experiences so very different from mine. Sierra Leone is one of many places I've traveled to throughout my career of making radio and sound and stories, and one of the topics of a talk I'm giving at Next Stage in Putney, Vermont, on Monday, March 31st. The talk is called Listening Beneath the Noise. Whether in post-conflict zones in West Africa and the Balkans, working with kids in America's urban environments, or discovering new ideas right here on Word of Mouth, I have come to consider listening to be a kind of lifeline.
If we continue to encourage the woman, they are so pan, all them boku, right there.
The tenuous peace in Sierra Leone is just one example of how listening encourages understanding. I crisscrossed that country after the 11-year civil war ended to help assess what it would take to set up a national network of community radio stations.
But Sheikh, last...
Now, serious thing I tell you so.
Last key question. If you not be woman, then you married. Don't say traditional married.
That particular?
Yes.
You may recognize a few words in the Pidgin English dialect from this episode of Atunda Ayenda. That's an extremely popular soap opera featuring characters reintegrating into the post-war nation. There are characters representing former child soldiers and rebel combatants and amputees and government officials and refugees and grieving citizens. This skit features a pair of men talking about an upcoming report on the status and rights of women. Episodes are produced every week to keep storylines current and to help seed discussions that may be heated, but that model dialogue between disparate groups without erupting into anger or violence. Hearing stories that warned against danger and communicated belonging is one of the reasons for the survival of our species. That capacity is hardwired in humans. I would go further and argue that careful listening promotes compassion and connection and can even resolve conflict, especially now in our heavily mediated multi-input world. It is the voices and stories that don't get airtime that interest me, like Janice Nieves, a teenager from Hunts Point in the Bronx, one of the poorest districts in the country. Janice recorded her own diary for WNYC's Radio Rookies Project and carried the tape recorder with her to confront her father about his heroin addiction.
When he finally came out the bathroom, I went at it. I wasted no time. You know, what makes you want to go and get cans from the garbage and take it to the supermarket? I mean, what makes you want to do that?
Because of how I make money.
But that's not the only way you can make money.
No, which other way?
Well, you can get clean and, you know, get other jobs.
But I'm dirty?
No, I don't mean... Okay, that's the wrong word. I'm sorry.
The way I look, the way I dress, the shirt, the pants.
No. Yeah. I'm talking about you doing drugs and thinking it's okay.
My quest to work with people whose voices are seldom heard brought me to the Third Ward of Houston, Texas, a bustling African-American neighborhood during most of the 20th century, until desegregation, urban renewal, and the crack epidemic left it mostly boarded up and emptied out. I worked there with local kids to collect the long-buried stories and memories of neighborhood residents whose families found work and community there, even if they were poor. Together, we shook the dust off the old stories of a vibrant neighborhood long left for dead.
It was a 24-hour street, Jack. I mean, folks lived on, I mean, they walked up and down the street. There was, you know, a lot of beer lounges, the El Dorado. That was the biggest thing the blacks had ever seen. humming. Baby, they talk about deep down, there are either one or two things that could happen to you. You either made it with a lady or you got yourself killed.
There are millions of similar stories tucked away and disintegrating in the minds of people and buildings that we may pass every day. Especially now when so many sources of information compete for our attention, it is often the loudest, most boisterous voices that get heard. Listening Beneath the Noise is about a lifelong pursuit of careful listening and what can come from it. You are warmly invited to come listen with me. Details on my talk and my visit to Landmark College in Putney, Vermont, are online at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Satisfaction guaranteed. It is a retail promise that usually comes with a good helping of small print, presumably to prevent customers from abusing liberal return policies. Still, a handful of established brands, from L.L. Bean to Nordstrom's, offer a true lifetime guarantee for merchandise with no exceptions. Joining us to contemplate the pros and cons of a promise that you cannot take back is Adweek staff writer Robert Clara. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
L.L. Bean, The North Face, Land's End, those household utensils with the spongy handles, they're all moderately high-end retailers. At least, let's say they're not bargain basement brands. Does that factor in the ability to offer a lifetime guarantee?
I think it does, yes, because there's a certain article of faith that these brands take when they extend a guarantee like this, and that is that their average customer won't take advantage of them. And if you are a bargain basement brand, I don't think that you can necessarily have the same assurances that a higher-end brand would have.
Well, I think we've all heard the stories, you know, retailers taking back items that are in some cases 5 or even 10 years old.
Oh, sure. And the brands that I talked to, surprisingly enough, admitted to me that that they do encounter that from time to time. So, you know, I certainly don't want to absolve all the higher-end shoppers out there as having, you know, better morals than anybody else. But retailers kind of see that as one of the drawbacks, but just a simple cost of having a policy like this, and believe that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages.
Well, I've seen on the internet, you know, stories of people taking advantage of these policies. There's REI. This is Recreational Equipment International, if I have it right. But everyone calls it Rental Equipment International. You know, they'll go camping or something and use something for a trip and bring it back after the weekend.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very, very big risk.
Backfire? I mean, how can some – is that sustainable for a business?
Well, in some cases, it might not be. I think the risk of customer abuse is higher when you're talking about a product that is maybe a single-use product or a specialty product, like, say, you know, to cite the camping example. If I'm not a regular camper, but I'm going to go on a camping trip and I don't have any equipment, that sets me up for a perfect opportunity to go out and buy a whole mess of stuff, use it once, and then return it. So an outfitter, for example, like, say, North Face or REI, is going to run a higher risk of that kind of abuse. And some of them will stick with the program, others perhaps not.
Yeah, you did find a list of 15 bold brand promises in your article for Adweek. Among them, some that I found surprising. I mean, Omaha Steaks. I can understand offering guarantees on outdoor clothing, but steaks?
Yeah, I was surprised by that too. But I mean, my guess is that one of the difficulties that any brand has really is differentiating its product. And when you're mail order only, which you know, that company will send you a steak through the mail, you know, the wonders of our time. And you know, if they stand behind it, it's a way for them to stand apart from the competition. So obviously, they've done the math and decided that, from a marketing standpoint, that makes sense for them.
You also have written about brands that offer lifetime guarantees, let's say with an asterisk or a catch, like the luggage company Briggs & Riley. What's their offer?
It's interesting. They really go out on a limb in one sense, in that if your luggage comes back damaged from the airline having mishandled it, they'll repair it. So that was impressive. On the flip side, though, and I guess, you know, this is understandable. They and a number of other brands will not, however, cover what they term normal wear and tear. And also, if I remember correctly, customer abuse. These things can be challenging to define. And even though I understand, certainly from a business point of view, why they would do that, it kind of makes the brands that don't attach any strings all the more impressive.
Huh. It does seem, however, like a lot of these are really established brands. I mean, we're living in an era where new products are popping up all the time. But in order to have a lifetime guarantee that's meaningful, you have to know that store is going to be there, that product is going to be there in a year or 10 years, right?
Absolutely. And I think that kind of cuts both ways, because the guarantee not only tells the consumer that the brand is in it for the long haul, but in many cases, the brands with whom I spoke had that guarantee in place since their founding. And in the case of L.L. Bean, that goes back to 1912, and the North Face back to 1968. So sometimes the guarantee is just simply a matter of maintaining what had been a customer service tradition all this time. But I guess the slippery slope here that we should mention is once you extend a guarantee like this, it can be a little bit difficult to back off of it. If you're going to tell the customer that you're in it for the long haul, that you'll back up your stuff, you know, for the lifetime of the product, however you want to term that, you've got all your chips on the table. I mean, you have to play for keeps.
When you were doing research for this article, you can admit to us, if this happened, did you try yourself to buy anything and then return it?
You know what? I didn't. But I'll tell you what gave me the idea for it is that we're an L.L. Bean family, because I'm originally from upstate New York. And I've heard stories of people walking into L.L. Bean with boots that are, I don't know, however many years old, and the company actually making good on the, you know, on the satisfaction guarantee. Obviously, in a case that I would consider an abuse, because look, boots are going to wear down after 25 years or however long, but the company is good to its word, and we, as the Clara family, I can say, has inadvertently tested L.L. Bean, but as consumers, not as journalists.
Robert Clara, author and staff writer for Adweek, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There is a link to read both of his articles about the elusive lifetime guarantee. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so we heard it there. The lifetime guarantee is a great way for companies to build loyalty and trust, but can backfire if customers abuse the policy. Last year, the outdoor gear company REI, as noted, nicknamed Rental Equipment International by many outdoor enthusiasts, canceled its lifetime guarantee policy because too many customers were returning old, worn gear for brand new replacements. Which brings up the question, can a policy that relies on consumer conscience be sustainable? Should consumers feel guilty about using the lifetime guarantee policy? And do they? Like many New England towns, we have an L.L. Bean outlet just a stone's throw away from our office. So we decided to send producer Zach Nugent around the NHPR office to see if our coworkers had taken advantage of their satisfaction guarantee.
Well, I had a zipper fall off of a fleece in the dryer. Foolishly, I called to see if they would replace the zipper. And essentially, she was like, no, we'll just replace the whole thing.
What was your reaction to that?
Awesome.
Did you feel guilty at all? Because you had this for 5 years.
Well, no, not really.
Okay.
I didn't feel guilty at all. She offered.
I've had these several years. It never occurred to me to return them.
Would you return them?
I probably wouldn't, frankly, just because... but I'm not sure what I mean, you know, I don't know, what would you even get for this?
a new pair, brand new.
Well, maybe next winter.
Yeah, I don't know.
I have used the lifetime warranty when, say, like after 2 years, the zipper on a winter jacket broke. And then I did sort of question the ethics of my decision a little bit.
Well, I actually have never used the lifetime guarantee, but I am a devoted L.L. Bean shopper because they offer it to their customers. I appreciate that fact, and I come back again and again because of it.
Most recently, I had an L.L. Bean headlamp that worked perfectly fine until I dropped it on concrete, and I broke it and brought it in and said, "This broke." And that was all I said, "This broke." And they said, "Great." It's sort of like shock that they're willing to do it, but not so much guilt.
I bought a pair of boots probably 3 years ago, but they fell apart. When I go to return the boots, I'll go and shop and buy some more stuff. So it's to their advantage, I think.
I use the lifetime guarantee for my JanSport backpack, which I hadn't been aware that it even had until the zipper broke. And I checked it out and I sent it back in. I think I'd had it for 4 or 5 years at the time, and it's lasted about that long again since.
So did you feel guilty at all about having a backpack for 5 years? That's a long time, and getting a brand new one for free.
No, no, it's part of the deal. I was very excited. Not guilty at all.
Okay, so my coworkers aren't feeling too guilty about returning broken items, even after years of use. But just how far is L.L. Bean willing to take their guarantee? I had to go right to the source to find that out.
My name is Mac McKeever, and I'm a senior public relations representative with L.L. Bean.
Okay, first, can you tell me how the L.L. Bean satisfaction guarantee started?
The satisfaction guarantee started actually over 100 years ago at the start of our company when our founder, Leon Wood Bean, developed the Maine hunting shoe. He went out to market this shoe, and he said, "This is the best pair of boots for hunting in Maine and New England and beyond, and I guarantee it. If you're not 100% satisfied with these boots, I'll return your money." So the first 100 orders came in, and 90 of those first 100 pair actually failed. But true to his word, he gave those 90 folks his money back, went back to the drawing board, perfected the boots, and then he truly revolutionized the outdoor footwear industry after that.
All right, well, I have some scenarios that I'm going to read to you, and I want you to tell me whether or not L.L. Bean would accept my return under the satisfaction guarantee policy.
Okay.
Could I return some L.L. Bean slippers chewed up by the dog?
Yes.
Could I return an L.L. Bean rain jacket that I've had for so long it no longer repels rain?
Absolutely.
L.L. Bean winter hat that I used to decorate a snowman but then forgot about, and it was half-eaten by a deer.
Yes.
L.L. Bean gloves that I cut the tops off of so I would look dangerous, yet still be warm while cruising around on my moped.
We would exchange those.
I'm dangling my feet over a volcano, and one of my boots drops in. I rescue it, but it's severely burned.
We would give you a new pair of boots.
Producer Zach Nugent speaking with Mac McKeever of L.L. Bean. And we'd love to hear your stories of wild returns from the consumer or the retail perspective. Share your dubious return tales on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Coming up after the break, when Girl Scouts go STEM. Stay with us for that story. You won't earn a patch, but you may learn something.
Word of mouth!
Here's a new milestone for the record books. This week, officials confirmed that 11-year-old Katie Francis had sold over 18,007 boxes of Girl Scout cookies, narrowly beating the previous record, which was set in the 1980s, by just 7 boxes. Considering that the Girl Scouts have been selling cookies to support troop activities since the early 20th century, it's quite an achievement. And got us thinking about the Girl Scouts' legacy and what organizations like the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts might look like in the years ahead. Will they last as long as a package of Thin Mints? Well, turns out there is a new co-ed version of Girl and Boy Scouts for the digital age, one where kids get to make up their own rules. Julie Sabotier, host of Destination DIY, brings us the story.
Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts are do-it-yourselfers by nature.
The organizations were founded on ideals like self-sufficiency and wilderness survival. These are timeless values, but some families find the 100-year-old scouting institutions to be a little out of touch. They require uniforms, their websites are clunky, and they have a lot of rules. But there's a new kid-driven, co-ed version of scouting for the digital age. It's called DIY.org. Their motto is, get skills, be awesome. And they have badges. They call them patches, but they look a lot like those things my mom sewed onto my Girl Scout sash when I was a kid.
One of my patches, what I'm proud of, is Duct Tape Ninja, making things out of duct tape.
This is Lucy Bowman.
I'm 10, and I like crafting.
Lucy has lots of patches.
Fort builder, shelter builder, prankster.
To earn a patch, a kid has to complete 3 challenges. Then they upload a picture or video of whatever they made. The DIY.org staff reviews it and doles out the patches.
Cardboarder, printmaker, paper crafter, and toy maker.
Before I say more, I should tell you that even though we both have the same 3 letters in our names, DIY.org is not affiliated with Destination DIY, except, of course, that we're talking about it on this episode of the show. Lucy was excited to show me a drawing she did to earn her illustrator patch.
My owl fish bear that I drew, it's a combination, a head of an owl, body of a fish, and legs of a bear. So I wanted to draw an owl, a fish, and a bear, so I just combined them.
The patches are digital, but they also come as tangible embroidered objects. Lucy has 10 of her patches sewn onto the bag she takes to school. The site is completely free for parents and kids to use. There are no ads, but there is a market on DIY.org that sells some do-it-yourself kits, backpacks, and the physical patches. They're $5 each. The virtual patches are free. They get displayed on the user's portfolio pages. Like many of the kids on the site, Lucy doesn't use her real name. Instead of a profile picture, she has an avatar.
My avatar, since it's sort of anonymous, I am a raccoon named Skitter Evil.
DIY.org is pretty new. It first went live in the spring of 2012, and they have about 200,000 users. That's according to this guy.
Hi, my name is Zach Klein, and I'm the CEO of DIY.
There's 2 acronyms I never expected to hear so close to each other in the same sentence. Zach is one of 3 guys who started DIY.org in San Francisco. He's 31, and he just so happens to be an Eagle Scout himself. One of his other claims to fame is co-founding and designing the video sharing website Vimeo. He doesn't have kids, but in creating DIY.org, he drew inspiration from his own childhood experience.
For example, when I was 11, I was really into making web pages. My parents had just signed up for AOL.
Welcome. You've got mail.
And AOL offered this really cool free tool where you can make a web page easily. And I was living in my own internal world, just making web pages. And there was no one in my life who understood the value of what I was doing. And there's no way they could have anticipated that what I was doing then would someday become a really important skill.
Zach says that's why a lot of the ideas for the skills on DIY.org come from kids who use the site.
We're not really good predictors of what skills will be valuable when these kids are adults.
Magician.
Hardware hacker.
Game designer.
Special effects wizard.
And so we have to treat the things that they're passionate about with the same level of importance and prestige as skills that have been traditionally valuable.
Gardener.
Chemist. Woodworker.
One thing all the kids on the site are learning is how to be social online. Kids can follow each other's portfolios and comment on each other's projects.
This is the first time for a lot of kids that they've had a virtual identity of any kind. The first time that they could act without the consequence of being seen. And so, yeah, just for the sake of our community being successful, we have to teach kids to be good digital citizens so that their contributions to the community are productive.
Many of the kids on DIY are not using their real names. That could make it easier for them to be mean to each other, but so far, Zach says they've had a no-tolerance policy for that, and it hasn't really been an issue. There are tools built into DIY.org to help parents monitor the way their kids are using the site, and kids can't sign up without parental approval. Even though the site is free, parents have to enter credit card information to verify their identity. It's a step up from checking a box that says, "I give parental permission," but of course it's not completely airtight. Like traditional scouting, parental involvement is a key component. The thing that I find really fascinating about DIY.org, and something that separates it from Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, is the way it exists in both the digital and the physical world. Some of the skills are purely digital.
Web designer.
Meme hacker.
Front-end developer.
But a lot of them require kids to step away from the screen and make something with their hands.
Painter.
Botanist.
Chef.
Stitcher.
Home builder.
Bike mechanic.
Then they create a digital record of their creative project, and it lives online where they can share it with their virtual friends. And in some cases, kids are also sharing what they're working on in person.
Okay, guys, if you want to put the chairs on either side and on the back, and then...
On a Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon, 7-year-old Mason Jones and his friend Cam Laraway help Mason's dad set up for the monthly meeting of the PDX DIY Club.
So it looks like we have a ton of awesome projects.
This is Ben Jones, Mason's dad.
In the back there, we have little bits, robot stuff. And then we've got perla beads, right, Mace?
He gets some help from other parents and teachers he knows, but Ben is the main organizer behind PDX DIY.
Our first event was at a bike shop. We've gone to a nature reserve to do the botany skill, and then we've been at a reuse center here in Portland called Scrap, and that's kind of been our home.
There are about a dozen kids working in pairs or with their parents on projects they brought or just whatever seems interesting to them. Mason and Cam are digging through a bag of plastic craft supplies.
A little one of these?
Yeah.
We don't know what we're making yet.
Clubs were not part of the original plan for DIY.org, but since they started popping up, the site has fully embraced the idea. There are 75 clubs listed on DIY.org, and a dozen of those are outside the U.S. Co-founder Zach Klein says there are more out there that are just not registered yet.
It's one thing to build something and get people to visit your website, but it's another thing to actually cause people to meet in the real world and to cause people to spend their Saturdays together doing something creative. It's a profound feeling, and I think it's probably started with families who maybe had dabbled with scouting, you know, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, but wanted to change. And they saw DIY, and they saw that we had patches, and they saw that maybe the skills that we were promoting were more contemporary than those organizations.
Maker.
Rocketeer.
Geneticist.
And they just started meeting and working together.
That's actually exactly how Ben Jones and his son discovered DIY. Unlike the more established scouting organizations, DIY.org encourages users to make up their own rules.
Human beings have a superpower, and it's called play. And I guess our theory is just that we want to give kids the tools and the power and the responsibility to go further with their play and to make them feel special and important for doing it.
DIY.org put that theory into practice in a new way recently when they released a handbook to offer some guidance to the clubs. It pushes them toward the next level of DIY. It says the clubs should be led by kids.
When I read that, it was like, holy cow, what do I do?
Ben says they're struggling to figure out how to adapt the PDX DIY club to get kids more involved in the planning and logistics. For him, it comes down to this key question.
How do we help kids the same way kind of DIY is helping all of the clubs, in that we're not telling them exactly how it should be done, but we're there to support them throughout the process.
They'll continue to meet monthly as they figure that out, and they invited me back for the next meeting. They'll be working on something that was never a part of my scouting experience, the journalism patch.
Julie Sabotier curates the public radio show and podcast Destination DIY. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to browse at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.